What time is it, you wonder? Well, it's time for Drinks with Tony on KPCRLP Santa Cruz 101.9 FM. Ba-ba-da-ba-bum.
Sound.
Tony Duchesne here. Welcome to episode 139 of Drinks with Tony with my guest Mick Harvey of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and many other projects, including his solo work where he adapted the songs of Serge Gainsbourg to English. That's what we cover in our interview. It's actually an unaired interview from 2017 when his fourth record of the Serge Gainsbourg Quartet of Records was released. And I cringe at listening to old interviews, especially with someone like Mick Harvey and his ilk, because I've been a fan of the Bad Seeds and the Birthday Party for decades. So it was really hard to try to forget that I didn't think of him as royalty in my mind. It wasn't like I was just interviewing a dude. I was interviewing royalty. And I feel like in the last 4 years, I've become a little more jaded when I interview someone. I don't know why that happened. I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I love interviewing and having conversations, but there's just a part of me that isn't thrown off like I used to be, like in this interview. Maybe it's some sort of maturity. I didn't get the Drinks with Tony ID from Mick Harvey, but I got it from another fella from one of my older Drinks with Tony interviews. You might even recognize the guy.
Hi, I'm Nick Cave, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show, yeah.
Well, I've been trying to get you for years.
Have you?
Yeah, it's...
I'm just so hard to pin down. I haven't been coming through America much in recent times, actually, since I last, you know, I did the last Bad Seeds tour in 2008.
Yeah.
And since then, I came with Polly to do, you know, when we did Coachella, and that was a kind of real flying visit, like five...
I think I saw you at the Warfield on that tour. Yeah, San Francisco.
It was a real lightning tour, and then I was gone again, and I haven't been back since.
Yeah,
I used to be kind of, you know, coming through America every 12 or 18 months, doing, you know, so it's quite unusual. I suddenly realized, geez, I haven't been here in a long time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, when I talked to Mona, and I was just like, oh, wait, I can get a sit down interview before the Serge Gainsbourg volume comes out. Are you kidding?
Well, it's out, isn't it? I think it's out in America now. The first one.
Oh, okay.
Delirium Tremens, yeah.
Oh, right, and then Intoxicated Women is in November.
Is in November, yeah.
Right, yeah, that was the one. That's when this is going to publish, is it?
Right. Well, that'll be good, because that'll come with the German version of Shatem. We'll probably do an English one, too, in the meantime, so it'll all be, you know...
Very cool.
It's probably appropriate for...
What,
So who are you writing for?
The Rumpus.
The Rumpus, okay.
Yeah, you've heard of it? Or no?
Yeah, I have, yeah. I don't read...
Yeah, you don't have to.
I don't really read many magazines, but I hear about them.
Yeah.
People say, you know, The Wire, and these uncut, and I'm like, oh yeah, it's a magazine in England. I just don't read anything, really. I see snippets from things, you know, I just don't read.
Yeah. There we go.
Don't read magazines.
What,
anymore, I've stopped.
Thank you. So you actually turned me on to Serge Gainsbourg in 1996 when I saw... Well, I was flipping through record stores. That's how you had to find out about music in those days.
Yeah.
And I saw the Mick Harvey. I'm like, Mick Harvey did a solo record, Intoxicated Man? And I went and I listened to it over and over. I didn't know it was Serge Gainsbourg songs until I read the liner notes. Yeah.
I mean, I think in America, a lot of people, it really was a kind of first exposure to some of his stuff. So... I mean, that's kind of nice. It wasn't specifically the purpose of it. Obviously, you have a mixture of purposes when you're working on anything. So you don't have one single idea about what it is or could be. So, but first and foremost, I was doing it for myself. You always have to have that primary starting point, I think.
Yeah.
Or you really don't know why anyone would do anything if they're not doing it for themselves, ultimately. But. You know, the fact that it's had some kind of, that it's helped people find his work is nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wanted them to find my work, really, too. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a bit... It's
well, I came
hard,
to you first,
to
and,
say,
then
but,
I, and then I caught Serge.
And this happened a lot in America. So in different countries, it's been it's been different. You know, in England, there was a little bit more knowledge about his stuff.
Yeah.
Probably because Shatem was a big hit there.
Yeah.
In 69, it was probably the number one hit in England. So people knew about him, but actually then you'd realise if you talked to people that they didn't actually know very much about him. You know,
right.
He was some sleazy Frenchman.
Right, who sang Lemon Incest with his daughter.
Yeah, and they knew two or three things like that about him, and right. Two or three songs or something, and they really didn't know much about him at all. So it brought a lot more, because for me, there's a lot of really great songs there, really amazing material. So,
yeah.
And it was kind of lost to the English-speaking world, or just obfuscated from them by lack of access, because it's in French, basically. That's basically the reason.
Right. So when did Serge Gainsbourg come on your radar?
Oh, in dribs and drabs over a long period of time, you know. Obviously Jetem, I think that was also, it was also a hit in Australia, or it's very known, that song in Australia. And somewhere along the line, I was aware of it, and there's another, I forgot, I was talking about it the other day, which song was it that I'd heard? And then I was in France in the early 80s, visited a friend of mine from Australia who was living there, and he played me Bonnie and Clyde one day, and I was like, really. So I'd heard quite a few bits and pieces, and I suppose across the years, and I remember from the early 80s, I had a postcard that my wife and I found somewhere, which was this little postcard of four Polaroid pictures by Serge called Life and Death of Felix the Cat.
Uh-huh.
And
wow.
For many years, I when people would ask me, you know, for my favorite.
You guys want a sparkling, right?
Okay. Sure, yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Now you have sparklings.
Right. I would quite like some sugar as well.
Yeah, I get you.
Seeing as the interview's
yes,
been
please.
Disrupted. Might as well get all the orders in at one go. Thank you, sir. So for many years when I'd be asked, you know, what my favourite Gainsbourg work song, what's your favourite thing by Gainsbourg, I'd just say Life and Death of Felix the Cat.
Yeah. Oh, because of the postcard.
Yeah, because of what? I really loved it. I thought it's a fantastic. You'd probably find it online now, you know.
Yeah.
We must have bought it in Paris or something. Just a funny poem with four pictures, you know.
I'll have to look for
this
it.
This is just a little doll of Felix the Cat, you know, standing there and then falling over and then...
Yeah.
It's just really stupid.
I hope I can find it, because then we can use it in the...
If you're allowed to.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, recreated by kind permission of... Anyway, that's the kind of thing I'm going to do. But, so I'd known about some of his stuff, and I knew, like a lot of people I found later, when they'd say, oh, yeah, no, I like Gainsbourg, and say, yeah, how many songs do you know? And they'd say, well, you know, they'd know three or four. Well, I was kind of like that.
Yeah.
And then was in Berlin, and I had a, you know, in that time, in the mid-80s, it was a real sort of meeting point for disaffected people from all over the world.
Yeah.
Who wanted to be somewhere where there was no nation and no, you know, Berlin. It was like a stateless city for a lot of the inhabitants. Not the Germans, obviously, but... So I had this really, you know, the French friend there, and he...
Just wanting to get some food?
No, we're good.
No, thanks.
Thanks, just checking.
Yeah. And he just, you know, I mean, must have got to talking, and he said, oh, I have the whole box set, I'll make you a cassette. So he did a compilation cassette for me, you know, which is... It was fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
It was on high rotation for quite a while.
Yeah.
And I just, I started thinking, you know, a lot of the songs are really entertaining. You could almost get an idea, because there's bits of English thrown in there. It's very, really entertaining to listen to. And after a while, I just thought, yeah, I'd love to know what these songs are about.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, what they're actually about. Like, what is it people talk about, how great his lyrics are. So I just wanted to investigate that and try and expose that, I guess.
And then when you did, then that became the passion to move forward.
Passion for me. Yeah, I don't know. I suppose you could describe it that way.
Okay.
Became the driving thing of it, to just, okay, well, let's try and show the songs for what they are to a, and it's made a huge difference for people, you know.
Yeah.
Even Steve Shelley in Sonic Youth was sort of down in Melbourne touring with someone. He was with Thurston, I think. And we were in the studio doing the last couple of days, and he kind of came down to visit because he's good friends with JP Shiloh, who's on the album, on all the album. And they sort of worked together, and anyway, long story. But he sort of dropped into the studio, and there was a couple of percussion things we needed to do. So I said, "Oh, Steve, get out there, Steve, get out there and do some. Yeah, go and do the tambourine on that then. I don't have to do it then, you know." So, and then we get Steve Shelley in the credit on the album too. So so he went out and said, and the lyrics, I think, and while he was in there, he heard Coffee Cup, the song, that we'd become the song Delirium Tremens. And I just,
okay.
And he said, "Oh, wow, man, you know, I just always thought it was about a cafe." And that's the point, you know, it's like, what are the songs about? And then he heard what it was about and was like, "Oh, it's a song to a woman and about," and, you know, it's a really entertaining lyric that kind of goes further and further into kind of metaphors about coffee and, you know, sort of parallels with her. And it's a very typical Gainsbourg development of a lyric where it ends up being all kind of disaffected and about something else than it started as, you know.
So yeah, yeah.
And he just thought it was about a cafe called Colour Cafe, you know. And so that's what I mean. You know, people just don't. You just don't really know what the songs are about, so it's really nice to just throw that in and go, "Oh, that's what he's..." It's kind of... I know it must be a revelation for people.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes. So,
yeah.
And even though, you know, there's always, as I say, there's always things being lost in there a little bit, and especially the poetry itself is always the thing that's lost in a translation.
And the context of culture, kind of.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's where the combinations of words and how they work together, and the subtlety of the word choice is always so specific to a language, yeah, and the culture that, yeah, you just can't possibly carry that.
Yeah.
It's just, you can't. So you have to do it in your way, but I mean, and keep retaining all the kind of fundamental thing, which is hard enough. Yeah, because they just don't relate, and the English language culture has a different sense, and it's just got a different sense and a different aesthetic to French. So you've got immediately the poetry is going to be different.
Yeah,
it's inevitable. So everything else, I try and keep it, the meaning and the feel, the intention, the you know, the meter and the rhyme. I try and retain everything as much as I can. So I think that's a really you know, for me, sometimes when I'm translating them, it's, or putting them into English and finding a way to do it, it's like a revelatory experience as well, because it's very strange. Sometimes you get if you do a literal translation, it also doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah.
But then when you start finding ways to rhyme it and putting it in, suddenly you start seeing where the meaning is too, because the literal translations are not, they're not actually accurate.
Right. You can't go into Google Translate and then just...
It comes out all a bit wrong, and it's like, what does that mean, you know?
Yeah.
And then once you start shaping it, you go, "Oh, that's what he's saying. That's what's in there." You look at the actual, like, you look at the French and you go, "Oh, he's kind of saying, he's saying that," and the translation doesn't quite say that.
Yeah.
You know, the literal translation doesn't quite say what he's saying in the French. And you're like, so you just have to shape all of that.
Yeah.
So it's, and as it comes out, you know, then the strength of the idea starts revealing itself once the English form starts resolving, you know. So it's a fun thing to do. It's a lot of hard work, but
yeah,
it's like chipping away at some sort of, you know, digging in an excavation, you know, for whatever they call them in English.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Archaeological dig.
Right.
Going, oh, brushing away the dirt for you.
There it is.
That's great.
I feel like on the musical end, I prefer some of your stuff over.
It's always a matter of taste, you know. And I'm that's nice. I'm not sure not everybody feels that way.
Right.
Yeah, inevitably. Yeah. But, you know, I just have to go into the thing and say, I would play that this way.
Right.
I just have to do it my style.
Yes.
Yeah. What I do with music, obviously.
Yeah.
You always try and make the music your style. It right. comes very naturally. You just play the song and go, well, let's do it this way, and then it's just there. You know, so.
That's even with your solo work when you've covered other artists, like Mano Negra with Out of Time Man. Yeah. And all that stuff, I listen to the originals, and most of the time I'm like, ah, I get that.
Yeah, that's nice. Well, you must like my aesthetic or something, because that's basically what I'm, you know, you just go and find, you know, you refer back to what you're, you stay in line with your own aesthetic.
Oh, that makes sense. You know? Yeah.
But and you bring that into the thing, so.
And then I did look up the Mano Negra video with Out of Time Man, and they're so, so much quirkier and sillier than
it's kind of quirky, silly thing. Yeah, but I mean that's partly because the lyrics there's so many mistakes in the English lyrics.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, they're like I couldn't actually sing it. Like I had to change a few of them because you just. Maybe people would argue poetic license for them, but you know, how did they, you know, if you looked at a transcript of the original lyrics, there's just mistakes in there, as well as sorry.
I'm taking off right now, but Brenda will take over.
Hello.
Yeah. Thanks.
That's lovely. Thank you. We're fine right now. Thanks, Brenda. Thank you. Excellent. I have to remember the name of a woman who looks like that. What was I saying? Yeah, just. Well, there's one, you know, even things like I throw my watch to the floor and the original says, it's so lazy. And I'm just thinking, maybe you can say that in French or Spanish, that your watch is lazy, but you can't, it doesn't sort of work in English.
Uh-huh.
Your watch can be crazy, you know, can be. I don't think you can say that the clock's wrong because it's lazy. It just didn't work for me at all, you know. So,
well, I can't remember what your.
It's gone crazy.
It's gone crazy.
Like,
okay.
Your watch has gone crazy. It's just like the situation. I don't know.
Right.
There were a few things like that. There were a couple of funny grammatical things that were like, well, I can't see that.
Yeah.
You know? it's just really terrible English grammar. I'm not going there. I can't do it. I mean, I'm not averse to bad grammar if it works.
Yeah, and even in the record of the songs where you're straight up covering other people, I guess you do have that aesthetic. That's just
well, you always have your own. You always bring your own aesthetic to it. You can't help it. I don't think even you know. So there are times when people just do pretty much a straight cover, and then it's got a different vocalist.
And that's just
boring.
A cover band. Yeah,
that's pretty boring. So.
Yeah. So when it comes to those, how do you choose amongst the? Do you find something and go, you know, that's great, but if I do it, I could do it in a way that's, you know, maybe have a different punch to it.
The whole kind of process of doing the four solo albums has been. It's gone through a kind of, you know, it's gone through a transition of different. Things. I suppose I began with. I just decided I'd like to do. To start doing that. Because I wanted to do something where the songs I was recording were ones that I had a strong personal connection with the content. You know, from a large cross section of sources. But fundamentally, they had to be. For the most part, I felt they had to be sort of unknown songs, pretty much unknown in some way. Obviously, the Mano Negra song is very well known on the continent in Europe.
I didn't know it until I heard yours.
No, it's really well known in France and Spain, and but not outside of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's obviously I have to sometimes say, well, or it's only a song that's only known in Australia or something like that. So then it's got validity to kind of expose it further, you know, whatever, from my perspective. So, you know, it's always a very subjective thing there with that. But I really didn't want to do any, you know, do songs that were kind of well-known everywhere.
Right.
So that kind of made it, like, you know, more obscure songs, or songs that aren't really well-known outside of certain places or times, you know, eras. So I just started with a list, basically, and I just made a list of songs that were really important to me personally. And just sort of, they just sort of selected themselves, really, which ones seemed to be the ones I should do first, or, you know, whatever. So
yeah.
The project kind of fell into the long-term project, which was kind of, I suppose, three albums, really, wasn't it? Because the sketches from the Book of the Dead is obviously a different thing.
Right.
And where I wrote all the songs, which that, I don't know why, that just happened along the way. But the other ones are like, one of those treasures, Two of Diamonds, and Four, they're sort of based around cover versions, you know, doing interpretations of other songs. So, interspersed with occasional original offerings from me. I don't, it's just the way it happened.
Yeah.
You know, you don't, it's really not unlike, I say this quite often because people sort of talk to me and say, well, you know, you're doing covers, why are you doing covers? Well, to me, it's not really about that. It's about presenting music that's important to you, and it's really not dissimilar to what some of my favourite artists like Johnny Cash and Nina Simone always did.
Yeah, yeah.
And these days people kind of go cover versions. Well, and they even talk about his American recordings as cover versions, but he was always doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you go back to his, he was only writing or co-writing, you know, a couple of songs, an album, or... Yeah. Nina Simone was always just doing a huge range of material. She had just, you know, she had a huge massive repertoire, and she would be choosing from this vast repertoire of songs from... But she wasn't strictly, you know, she wasn't really a songwriter. She started writing odd songs through the 60s, and a little more so when she got into the civil rights movement, but she was still just using other people's material and interpreting it and stuff. So it's, you know, I think it's a really important tradition. You don't have to always be writing songs. It's just, you know, some people are songwriters.
Yeah.
They've got a... They're driven to do it. It's kind of the thing that is their thing. Like Polly, for instance, she's a songwriter and a writer.
Right.
That's what she does. It's really her main thing. She really keeps that very, like, she does that. She doesn't really co-write or stuff like that. It's really important. It's like a thing that she does by herself. Well, Dylan is a songwriter. What can you say?
Yeah.
I'm not like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not my thing. So... I don't think it was Nina Simone's thing either. She was about presenting music that was important to her, and ideas and moods and feelings and stuff. She didn't have to have writing, whether she wrote it or not, was secondary, completely secondary. And she would choose to, you know, most of the stuff she does, I hardly ever know the originals, you know. Or, I Love You Porgies from some other thing. You know, Wild Is the Wind was by someone else originally. It was in a film, I think, originally. You know, there's a few songs where I know that she's done a kind of classic, but mostly they're really obscure, the songs she picks too, so they become her material, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And then working with Polly, have you been on the last two records?
Yeah.
Cool. Are you pretty much in the band? I mean, is it you're the goat? It's Let's Start a New Record. Is that how it works?
Well,
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, no. I'm not sure how it works. She has actually asked me to work on every record she's made since we met.
Mm-hmm.
But she could also not ask me at any moment.
Yeah.
She's the boss.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's good. I like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's, yeah, so I'm kind of, she comes, but I mean, the starting point is, it's hard to explain, actually, because we're kind of really, we're just kind of really close friends. So, obviously, I have enormous respect for her, and I think she's brilliant. If she asks me to work on her record, I'll think about it. I mean, if I can. There were a couple of records where I really couldn't be in England in the weeks that she needed me there. And I just really can't be there, you know. So I didn't play on Aha Her, and I didn't play on White Chalk. I just couldn't. I couldn't be there in the critical time when she needed me to be there. So, but any time if she asked me to be available, I would. And I, as I was available, I would be there. So, she's my friend, so I would just as a friend in the first place, I'd be there. And she's a great artist, so I don't have to worry about that.
Right.
So happy to work on anything she.
Yeah.
Presents to me, and if I'm available,
yeah,
you know, I suppose in the not only did I have my son's 16 now, but he was much younger, but so he's, you know, like 6 or 7, whatever he was, 9. I can't just be, you know, over in England for 4 weeks, not even knowing what I'm doing. I've got to, you know,
right.
And the Bad Seeds were still going. There were probably things, you know, I was probably on tour or something, you know. So yeah. Different things had come up where I wasn't able to be involved, but you know, basically I guess To Bring You My Love, Is This Desire, I'm on both of those albums, on a few tracks on both those albums, and then we did Stories From The City, I co-produced. So then I missed the next two albums, and I've done the next last two albums.
Oh, okay.
And that's right, because Stories From The City was before my son was born, and the next two albums, just with the Bad Seeds and with having a child, it's just too, and living in Australia is just too complicated sometimes. So. And the last two albums have worked out again.
On your timeline of your life, now that you have a son, that happened when he was 7.
Very much. Sometimes, yeah, yeah. Do you have kids?
I don't know.
It does work out. You go, oh, I don't know. Must have been like that. Oh, that was before he was born. Oh, no wonder we were free and easy and traipsing around there. Why, what were you doing in Greece? Oh, yeah, he wasn't born yet, you know. It's like that. So it's good. It's a good marker, especially as he was born in 2000.
Yeah. Oh, that's perfect.
He was born in the year 2000. So it was really easy to work out. You don't have to do any math either. You just go, oh, so he was 7 or 8, you know. So what's going on?
If I remember right, he played on some of the new record, yeah? Is that correct or no?
Who?
Your son?
Oh, he does a guest vocal on one track on the next album, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
And my wife, I did the song at the closing track of the thing with Katie.
Hi. Oh, is that
you
funny?
Going to the pool? It's hot up there. That's Paul,
yeah. Yeah.
Heading to the pool. Trying to be anonymous.
Right.
This way, through the gate here. We've just been talking about you. Well, go away.
Every time I come to this side of town, I feel like I need to work out. I need to do more push-ups and get a tan.
No, I don't know.
Oh, it's your son.
She's really cute.
Oh, well, I've had a crush on her for decades.
She just showed you her bikini top.
I know. I think that was the best moment of my life right there. Glad I can share it with you.
She's great. She's really such a sweetheart. I mean, and she, you know, she seems from the outside like very. She's very private, so she doesn't do that whole thing with. But you know, if you, because she's very protective about having her world.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's. But you know, as on a, on a one, you know, private level, she's just a total sweetheart. So
yeah,
and very quiet and not what people would think at all. You know.
It seems like you have to have that grounding and to have the longevity in the industry of entertainment.
I think she did very early. She kind of when she saw that it was taking off, probably really over the first album, she just built kind of a bit of a wall around herself immediately. So.
Which the publicists don't want you to do. They want you to spill it all.
Well, here they do. In England, probably less. In LA, they just want you need to be parading in front of the paparazzi all the time.
Yeah.
That's what they prefer. Not so much like that anymore. Yeah. They kind of understand if someone wants to be more, not in that situation. So,
yeah. I'm a couple years new to LA, so the mind fuck has been. I'm fortunate I live on another side of town where it doesn't feel like this at all.
It's a strange town to live in.
Yeah.
If I've spent longer, when I've been here for longer times, like a few weeks even, I start getting the thing and it's like, whoa, not my world.
Yeah.
Not my kind of way to approach stuff at all. I don't get it. You practically have to kind of have a little pricey CV when you say hello. Insane, all that stuff. I just don't.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Nick Harvey, # Nick Cave, # PJ. It's just like,
what?
Fuck. I can't do it.
Yeah. No, I have it on such a lesser level, but I have a novel and then the film based on the novel's coming out next year.
Oh, yeah.
So nobody, they're just like, oh, yeah. Oh, wait, you wrote that? Oh, and you work with Eric Stoltz? And then all of a sudden they want to talk to you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I don't like about it.
Yeah.
But then they're interested in you. Fuck that.
I'd rather not know. And
exactly.
Just.
So what's the film? What's it called?
Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I grew up a Jehovah's Witness, so it's a love story set in the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Set
in the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I'll look out for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to talk to you.
Still doing okay?
Yeah.
We're doing great, thanks.
Yeah.
We're still talking to each other, so we're good.
So I've got. Oh, yeah. Actually, I've just.
Are we getting close?
No. We're good. We're good. I got a message. I was planning to text my friend before we started, and I forgot because we got distracted by the sky bar and everything. So I can just text Bambi and tell her what we're doing because she's picking me up for lunch.
Okay. Cool. Do you know where you're going to lunch at?
No.
I wish I knew more about this side of town. I know the taco stands in Echo Park.
you're that far away from this side of town?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Right, because Echo Park's a long way from here.
Yeah, and I also teach at UCLA Extension, so I teach tonight, so I'm just staying on this side of town after we talk.
All right, UCLA's over towards Santa Monica, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Along that way.
Yeah, we're pretty close to it right now. So I just brought my other work, and then I could transcribe this at the same time. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just told her to come here and find us here, so...
Great.
Cool. I don't know, anything else... Sorry, we got off subject. Anything else you want to ask,
When did you move back to Melbourne? Was it Melbourne? Did I say that right?
Yeah, we... Melbourne. We just call it Melbourne.
Melbourne.
You're allowed to have an accent. It's okay.
Yeah, okay. I want to feel like I'm in people's cultures, even if they're in L.A.
English people say New Orleans. New Orleans.
Right, true.
There they say New Orleans, and I say New Orleans. New Orleans. I'm somewhere in between the two now.
Right.
Because I can't go back to calling it New Orleans after having been there for a while. It's like, I can't call it New Orleans anymore. It sounds wrong. You know what I mean? Brisbane is wrong.
Brisbane.
Melbourne. which is sort of like Melbourne, but just compacted.
In the Bay, in San Francisco, the city south of San Francisco is Brisbane. It's spelled the same way.
Okay.
It's just like
that's
a little
why everybody, yeah. You see, you know, that's just Brisbane. I'll just say Brisbane. We were sort of in Europe, and my wife decided she wanted to do a fine art course, and she looked at prospects in Europe and just sort of decided she wanted to do it in an English-speaking country. Should have done it in America. We ended up back in Sydney anyway. She went to the National Art School in Sydney. And then once she'd finally finished that, after about 4 years, we took 1 year off. We were back in Europe again in 94 or something. And we were back in Sydney in 95, you know, based there. I mean, it's always with me, it's always like being based somewhere. It's
just,
sort of normally say I was living in Berlin like from 86 to 91, but I was based there, so I was only there half the time. The rest of the time you're on tour or you're recording somewhere else. That's
right.
Crazy life. So we were based there, and then once she had finished that at like 95, was sort of one, you know, we wanted to buy somewhere, to get a house somewhere. We had no idea. We didn't want to move back to Berlin because that was in such flux at the time. We weren't really sure. We'd sort of felt like we'd done our Berlin time, and we weren't sure what the city was turning into anyway.
Right.
And didn't really feel like going back there was any path forward. Barcelona was already getting super trendified. It was already on that path. It was like, Barcelona. You know, we were very keen to move to Barcelona at one stage, and it just never happened. We didn't know where we wanted to go in Europe. So we kind of got a place in Melbourne then, because we thought, well, we'll always use that. Even if we move back to Europe, we'd come back in the summer for a couple of months, so it'll always be useful to have somewhere here. And then we thought, oh, well, actually, our parents, we haven't lived in the same city as our parents for 16 years, and they're getting a bit old, maybe good to kind of hang around. So we went, you know, we're based there now. So.
Yeah.
We're still based in Melbourne since 96, really.
Oh, wow, okay.
Oh, it's great. You know, I travel, you know, obviously I travel a lot, so it's not like I'm missing out. I get my Europe experiences, you know, every year, and like I said, I haven't been coming to America much, but I travel so much for the job I'm in that I still get a lot of that stuff. I'd like to live in Europe, actually. I would have just never moved home, actually, if things had happened a bit differently.
Yeah.
But they just happened that way, and then we were based there, and it's like, oh, that's okay, it doesn't matter. You just go with what happens, you know.
I would love to see you live in America. I have to go see you in Europe, I guess, if I want to see you perform solo.
Solo, well, I do some shows in Australia, and I have done some shows. Yeah, I've done quite a few shows. Not recently, I haven't done anything last year. I didn't know, actually. Yeah, last October, September, I was doing a few solo shows, and I did a couple of Gainsbourg shows. Four Gainsbourg shows. And around this time, about a year ago now, actually.
Is it hard to, would it be hard to put a solo tour of America together?
I think it would be. One of the main stumbling blocks is the, is getting an agent who's interested.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, to put together, and I get a lot of different expressions of interest from individual places and people.
Right.
Who could put a show together.
Yeah.
But to put a tour together,
yeah,
you kind of need an agent.
Yeah.
And agents in America don't see someone like me as anyone who's going to really advance their career very much.
Is that the case?
Yeah, sure. I said, I'm not going to be, probably not going to be a big, people in the music biz and in these kind of businesses, they're looking at something that's going to go...
Right, right.
I hate to be a bit cynical about it, but it's not even being cynical. That's just actually just being realistic about it. That's the emphasis is more on that in America than it is in some other places.
Huh. That's a bummer.
Well, it is a bit of a bummer. I really put my mind to it, I could probably sort something out. But I've always got so much I'm doing. I'm very, very aware now that I've never played in America, like a solo show. And it's a bit like, well,
I'd like to bring that awareness to you even further. Make sure that you know that we're here waiting for you.
If I were already here, you know, if I could get a couple of shows that I could, you know, that would pay like guarantees of like some sort of festival-y type things or artsy thing that I could hang it off and do some other shows, you know, I'd be happy to do it, you know.
Yeah.
The Gainsborough thing's a little more difficult because it's more expensive because I have like a four-piece band and I have to have at least one female singer and pay four string players.
Right. Yes.
So that needs a kind of... But there's a guy in Canada who's interested to try and put some things together.
You're coming closer. Canada's getting closer.
Yes. And he wrote to me and I said, well, look, if would you be able, you know, would you be able to organize maybe some shows in the States as well?
Yeah.
Just, you know, strategically, they'd only have to be kind of San Francisco, LA, New York, and you know, something like that. It could be great.
Yeah.
Did it off the back of a couple of events in Canada, it could be really good. I don't know.
The when Crime and the City Solution did the reunion, they did five shows in America,
mm-hmm.
and I made it to the San Francisco show,
uh-huh.
and was stoked. You know, the plan was they were going to come back and tour again.
No.
And then that never happened. Yeah. That's I guess probably for the reason that you may have, prior to the reason may have been. Because they're looking for the big breakout, or I don't know.
Well, I
think that could be.
I think they were just looking for. Well, they were trying to make it. They were probably trying to make it financially viable and get that happening. And I think that it didn't quite work out. Like they did some shows in Europe too, and then they came to Australia, and I think it wasn't working that well financially, you know. It was okay, but it was like it was a strain and difficult, and by the time they got to a certain point, Alex kind of pulled out.
Oh, okay.
Said if you can't
pay us. He started doing the gypsy thing with his wife.
Yeah but that was also because Danielle was in the band too, then there was certain demands. I mean, well, you have to pay us this much per day, or we can't, you know, at least sort of, you know, whatever per day. Well, we can't. You know, we have to make a living,
yeah,
basically.
True.
And
food is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it was, you know, there were financial constraints on the whole thing, and then it was a bit like, well, they just pulled out.
Huh.
So that's actually what happened.
Yeah.
The money wasn't going as well as it needed to, and a couple of people pulled out.
Yeah.
And then it sort of all stopped. So I think Simon's working on another album with people.
I've been a fan of his solo
work. But it would be without
too.
Alex and Danielle and probably
David Eugene.
I think David kind of bailed as well. He didn't go to Europe or Australia. I think that's because he was doing his own stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so then you got that difficulty as well. And I think if Alex weren't there, he wouldn't be involved either, because they were like, you know, they're like soul brothers or something.
Huh.
So if you've seen Alex's bail, he'd probably go, oh, well, I'm not doing it then. So, and Jim White, I think, had difficulties with, you know, there were personal difficulties in the team. Put together a big band with all these weird characters, you know, Jim White from the Dirty Three, and you know, he was playing drums with them.
Oh, okay.
I think he found he had difficulties with some of the personalities in there, so I don't think he'd go back in there either. So, you know.
And I just remembered in Wings of Desire, no wait, you weren't in Crime in the City.
Yeah.
You were in Crime.
I'm at the piano. You see me for a split
okay,
second.
Okay, so you're Nick Cave in the Bad Seeds.
Yeah, I was in both. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's.
I was the main consultant from the two bands, talking to Vim about what we were doing. And
oh really?
Yeah, because I was in both things, and it.
Yeah.
That sort of put me in a position where I was discussing and understanding our roles in the role of the music and the bands in the movie generally, because it was like more than just a, you know, isolated appearance. So I was trying to understand what he was trying to do with and choosing the songs and all that stuff. So I was, you know, I had a few meetings with him, and that was good. You know.
I've interviewed him a couple of times, and we talked about Wings of Desire. It was really funny because it was in the middle of what do you call it? It was like press junket, so it was just like one of me after the other.
Yeah.
So he was just like doodling and answering questions, and then I was like, what about getting Crime in the City Solution and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, you know, and Wings of Desire? And then he's like, oh, now we're talking. And he just like, he lit up. And
because he's just a big music fan.
Yeah, he was at all of. He says he was like he would try to be at all of your shows.
Yeah, yeah, and he's total. He's been, you know, he's always got, you know, incredibly flattering things to say about us, which is always nice. You know, flattery will get you everywhere. So, you know, Vim's great. I really like him. Okay, I speak to him sometimes, but, you know, he's just in this crazy Vim Vendors world.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to be ringing him up going, hey, Vim, what are you doing? Because we just don't have that relationship. But,
right.
You know, if he's called me a couple of times in the last 5 years about weird things that have come up, and we just start talking for, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like your old friend.
Well, those are great. Those are great friends,
but we're just kind of, you know, there's a kind of trust there and an understanding, and got a funny back history, and it's just like, yeah, that's nice. But it's quite funny because I bumped into, after all these years, about last November, I was in Paris doing this Australian show, and I won't go into that just long detail. And at the after show, Claire Denis was there, you know, the assistant director, who became a really kind of well-known director after Wings of Desire. She made all those films. And I hadn't seen her since the shoot.
Oh, okay.
I hadn't seen her since, when I was 85, I don't know where we shot that film, 86 or whatever. So that was really strange, and she just went, and she was going, Mick Harvey! And I was just like, Claire, hi. You know, I barely remember that I'd really had much to do with her,
yeah.
You know, because it's a film shoot and there's all this stuff going on. But she was the assistant director, and she was just like, "You were the one who did everything." I was like, "Oh fuck, not again." Was it, you know, because I was just discussing everything with them, you know, all the diva kind of. I suppose the others were probably all on drugs and some description, and not aware. But I kind of understand the film show, kind of very aware of what's going on in that sort of situation. So I was kind of triangulating everything, you know, and, you know, that's just what I done. I can't help myself.
Well, from what I understand outside, and this may not be true, but it was kind of like, through Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, you were the centerpiece of keeping things going.
For a while, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
In different roles or with different emphasis in different times, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, on some level, yeah, in what could be considered like difficult times with drugs and stuff like that, or just chaos generally in the group kind of forming itself into a consistent unit, yeah, I was kind of central to hold, you know, kind of unifying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Brenda.
See, you don't forget me.
did you think? I never thought the longevity would go so long with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Yeah, well, I kind of did because, in his shorts, I've never seen that before. So, I kind of did because it was always going to be Nick with what could be a flexible, you know, a flexible kind of group of people. It could always be changing, the dynamic could be shifting, and he could keep using that. So, I mean, quite early on in the Bad Seeds, I just thought, oh, this is sort of something you could grow old with.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Straight away.
It's yeah. Kind of,
because it had the capability to really evolve, whereas something like the Birthday Party was inevitably going to self-destruct. So, yeah, no, I always thought it had that potential.
Yeah, and then bringing in other people.
And, you know, and I kind of knew with Nick, even though from the outside he might have seemed like, you know, the next cab off the rank to, you know, overdose or not make it to, you know, all that sort of stuff, I always understood about Nick that he was very focused and sort of quite a deep, you know, he has a deep well of ideas and to draw on, which you could see already. There's much more there than even what might have been on the surface then. Yeah. I mean, he was obviously already had that. He was demonstrating what a good writer he could be, and it's kind of, I suppose, it's inevitable, as long as he doesn't. blow his mind or something, that he's just going to keep developing that. So that's right. Just that's just a kind of ability that he's going to be able to use over time. You know? So, and that's the core of why it works. So,
yeah,
I kind of always felt that it was a long term thing.
Yeah, because the first time I saw you guys was in 1990 at the Warfield,
mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh man, these guys are great. And then I was waiting for a record that would. I was just waiting for it to go bad because I didn't want to be a fan of a band for that long. And it just never went bad.
Some people would disagree. Some people, you know, they like early stuff and then they think it goes funny with The Good Son or something. But it's just going through phases.
Yeah.
It's actually just phases and variations into other areas of kind of the same... It's the same vision about the work, you know. So it's kind of good that it goes... off tracks. I mean, there's a couple of albums that I like less than others, but for the most part, I just, you know. Anyway, it's now one.
Oh, okay.
So Bambi could turn up at any minute.
Cool. So I'll get the wind down going.
Yeah, it's a slight wind up, but you're welcome to keep going. And is there anything else you wanted to ask me? I mean, I can waffle on all day. That's my problem.
That's great.
You know, I can just kind of keep talking, and sometimes I just want to shut up.
I
just start having a chat with someone, you know, I don't know. If it stops being like an interview where I'm finding the questions annoying, you know, that's just, I don't know. I don't mind talking all day. Bambi.
Like,
there you go. Look at that timing.
For some reason, when I saw you walk in, I was like, that's her.
The one who looks a little lost all the time. That's me. Good to see you.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi, Bambi.
I'm Tony.
Nice to meet you, Tony.
Oh. So we'll wind down. I wanted to ask you about Roland S. Howard, and because the street was named after him.
Oh, the lane.
Yeah, yeah.
The back lane full of rubbish bins.
Is that what it is?
That's the first thing you see after you sit down. That's just not right. That's just not right.
Wait, you played a part in, what was it? I got this from
petitioning,
a friend.
Petitioning the council? No.
Oh,
no,
okay.
I had absolutely nothing to do with it. I was, my general comment about it was, it's an insult to name a scummy little back lane full of rubbish bins after him. They should rename the main street. They just should rename Fitzroy Street. Who cares about the Bastard Song of the King anymore, anyway?
That's on record.
Yeah.
All right, cool. And,
Fitzroy, it means he's the bastard son of the king.
Is it?
That's what it means, Fitzroy of the king.
Wow.
So who's Fitzroy anyway? There's a whole suburb named after Fitzroy in Melbourne. And, rename Fitzroy Street. Okay. Much better.
And then
that was my basic. But actually, I did sort of put in my, you know, my anonymous support and everything, petitions and stuff with them. But I wasn't actively involved.
And I actually bought Teenage Snuff Film when it was still on clear vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine from Australia was like, when he came over my house, he's like, "How the hell did you get this? They only pressed 500 copies." I'm like, "What?" On the clear vinyl one, and then
clear vinyl. There you go.
Yeah. Then I had to pay rent. So I had to sell it, and then he bought me the
reissue.
Yeah. So anyway,
that's a bit better. Let's put his shorts on.
Yeah.
So what did you want to say about that?
What I was getting at is I think that you did a better version of "Come Into My Sleep."
But that has nothing to do with Roland's albums.
Oh, no. Oh, we were talking about Roland's albums, because you were on
I'm on both of them.
And Pop Crimes. Yeah. And how was that experience coming back and working with Roland? Had you seen him in a while, or how did that?
He'd get in touch when he needed some money, yeah.
Is that what it was?
I'd see him from time to time, yeah. when it came around to royalties time, it's like, "Mick, are the royalties in your..." He was a funny guy. I mean, he had an odd sort of lifestyle, and he was always, you know, it's really good when I see him in Melbourne. He was always very chatty and always had some funny stories to tell.
Yeah.
But you know, he'd keep to himself. He's a bit of a, you know, sleep through the day, a bit of a vampiric kind of lifestyle, and just, you know,
I don't know why I got really nervous go out when much. Bambi showed up. All of a sudden, I feel like an interviewer.
They just sit around. Yeah, we were just having a really nice chat.
No, it's fine. But I mean, you can't leave now.
How to describe my relationship with Ron? Because it was always kind of difficult too. You know, it was always a bit like. There was always sort of underlying tension there too, because he'd always been kind of upset about things that happened after the band broke up, and you know, that Nick and I just continued on working together and felt aggrieved about that. And so there was kind of always this, and he had a tendency to embitterment. He really did spend a lot of time feeling sorry for himself. It's completely fair to say that, because he was like that all the time.
I've noticed in the interviews and in the documentary that
he's just really like that. Yeah, that's what he's like. It's a little annoying. Sometimes you just think, well, we'll just get over it or something, you know, but that's just the way he was. So, but we always got on really, you know, we got on fine when we'd see each other. And he asked me to work on his records, so he obviously... wanted me to do something. If not see me all the time. Yeah, he wanted me to work on his record, so.
Great.
And that was.
Who doesn't?
Some people. And he was. You know, they were great. The recordings were good. The Pop Crimes was really difficult because he was very sick by the time we were working on that. It was very hard to. We spent a lot of time arriving at the studio and sitting there for 4 hours. So after a few days, I just started saying, okay, Roland, I'm coming around at 12:30 and I'm in the car and I'll pick you up tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
To get him into the studio. But then he'd come in and he'd only be able to work for a few hours and then he'd go home again. So JP and I just kept working on the album when he wasn't there, you know, as much as we could. But it got done, the album.
Yeah.
An album got made, so that was really fantastic.
Yeah.
And he actually wrote the last couple of songs he needed to write. Took him a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it was good to get him to do that, because it could easily just have not happened. And the guy from the record label actually was really instrumental in that too. He just made the whole thing happen. So it was really, you know, took a few people to get it to happen. But, you know.
And smash cut back to Intoxicated Women. So this is the final installment of the game.
Yeah.
And
I should have got you to sing a song. Oh, you were here.
Oh, well.
Too late now. And Loeen, who I actually would like to have got her to sing a song too. It was impractical.
Was there someone that you asked that you didn't think would be able to do it, and you got them, and you're like, oh my God, that happened.
No.
Alright.
I was hoping to get Anita to do a song as well on the new record, but we kind of had a bit of a blow up at some thing we were doing, and it just wasn't going to work. So that was disappointing. But apart from that, I just selected people depending on the song.
Yeah.
Mostly kind of obscure people you won't have heard of.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost exclusively, I suspect.
Oh, and I was gonna let you know, because when I first saw Nick Cave in the Bad Seeds, and then after that, I was totally intrigued with everyone in the band. So I wanted to know what everyone was doing. That's why I would grab your solo record, I would grab D Hout, and did I say that right? I'm not sure.
D Hout, yeah, it was perfect.
And then
didn't even notice that. It's...
And then with James, because I knew James was in the Bad Seeds, but I didn't know he was in Gallon Drunk. And I saw Gallon Drunk open for Morrissey in 1991.
So I was... God, what an event.
Yeah, well, I...
Is this the fizzy? That's the fizzy one.
Yeah.
Wow, you better drink it.
But
they're going to hit us over the head for that.
But,
okay, would you like some?
That's the one that hasn't been used.
Cheers.
Oh, cheers. Cheers.
A light. Cheers.
Choice today.
Better light than never.
But what was what I loved about that, going to that show, because I'd seen Morrissey a few times, I was like, okay. But this band Gallandrunk is amazing.
Usually they're pretty nuts, aren't they?
Usually I didn't get there. I got there early this time, and I was a fan after that. And then I didn't realize.
Well, Terry, who's the saxophone player, he's playing with Polly too.
Wow.
So, if you remember the saxophone player.
Yeah. So it's kind of a super group behind Polly.
It's a super group.
Yeah.
Very weird collection of people.
Yeah. But it kind of seems like you've all been around the neighborhood with each other for decades. In some sort of fashion.
No. There's a few people in the band who are really pretty new.
Oh, okay.
Actually, it's two Italian guys and a black drummer from London who's really recent.
Are you okay playing with Italian guys?
With Italians?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty funny.
Okay.
As long as they're not in their own country.
What happens then?
Yeah.
Then they turn into real Italians. Ah, no.
But years ago I was in Italy and I just felt overwhelmed.
Yeah. I didn't do it.
Okay. We'll close it off at that.
Listen. You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
No, they're fine. They're really funny. In fact, there's kind of an ongoing comedy routine.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, and that's all you're going to tell me?
Well, you know, they're very entertaining. It's just they say hilarious things in English that they don't mean to say, and you know, it's just
it keeps,
and the discussions about that, you know, it's always interesting.
It keeps the lulls and touring active.
No, they're good.
That's cool. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Mick Harvey on Drinks with Tony. Check out his solo records where he covers Serge Gainsbourg's songs and translates them into English. He's also of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and he remastered all their works around 2011, I think. Next week on the show, we have Eric M. Johnson. He'll be discussing his book, Whenever a Happy Thing Falls. Keep reading, keep singing loudly in your car, keep dancing in the grocery aisle, and I'll see you next week on Drinks with Tony. Thanks for listening to Drinks with Tony. You are on your radio dial at 101.9 FM, KPCR LP, Santa Cruz.